Now, I started off this morning, left the monastery quite early because I was invited to do a dana, to a house blessing, but the significance was actually a marriage, so it was actually a marriage blessing. So we had some nice Thai food in the morning and did a marriage blessing, and everybody was happy. Everybody was at their best behavior, and the food was delicious, and the world seemed like a wonderful place. And then, having had a lovely day's morning, a lovely meal, smiling people, I went to Frio for a funeral. And everybody was sad, crying. Actually, not everybody, to my amazement, and because that's actually what made me think of it, because I was quite impressed with the person whose daughter died, only about early 20s. Just dropped dead, just like that. And she was amazing. And sort of contemplating on the afterwards, you know, what it was that kept her so strong. And maybe I'll tell you a bit later on, but first of all, I just sort of thought that it was one of those days, you know, the ups and downs of life. First you have everybody happy, and then you have everybody cry. And it was just a classic. It was just one of those days that kind of really remembers or reminds you of what life is all about. Mm-hmm. Craving for the high, craving for the happiness, but then unable to avoid the suffering, because they're part and parcel. It's like just two sides of the same coin. And there's a couple of things I said at the service at the funeral. Was that what the Buddha talked about, the intoxications of life, you know, youth, health, and life. You know, once we're young, we think we're always going to be young. Once we're healthy, we think we're always going to be healthy. Once we're alive, we're always going to be alive. And that's the delusion. And that's what keeps us craving for the high in life, craving for the peaks, you know, the day of our marriage, or the winning of the lotto, or the journey up the Amazon, or the mountain climbing, or whatever high we get, you know, whether it's the pill on the weekend and then comes edgy Tuesday, or whatever it is, you know. We crave our high, and then when that high disappears, there is the low, the peaks and the troughs of life. And it's quite amazing to see that no one really wants to have, or rather, no one really wants to not have either. Even though it should be quite obvious that we can't have only one of the two. We can only have so much happiness. We can only have so much joy and pleasure and ecstasy. But then comes always the price to pay. There's always a price for everything. But most of us, if not all of us, are quite willing to pay that price, aren't we? So long as we get enough of those highs, so long as we can get enough peaks, we're quite happy to suffer for those things, to pay the price for those moments of happiness, aren't we? And that's what keeps us going, isn't it? Because we don't know any better. We don't know any better, and that's why few people in the world ever go for the middle way, ever go for peace. Because peace is the middle way between happiness and suffering. Now, the highs that we get, the peaks, they're like moments where there is a lot of extreme feelings. Like on the level of feeling, you know, the intensity of feeling is what people crave, isn't it? It's the intensity of pleasure measured in the senses, yeah? Through sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. It's mainly those five senses that we know. That's our world. It's the five sense world. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. However much pleasure we can derive from these five senses, that's where we measure, whereby we measure our happiness. And the more intense the feeling is, the more intense the pleasure is. And of course, the opposite is also true. The more intense the negative, the painful feeling is, the more we suffer over it. And those two are completely related. They have to be related, because the amount of suffering we have is always born of the amount of pleasure that went just before. Yeah? So they're completely conditioned upon each other. Yeah? The amount of happiness we have now determines how much we suffer when that which we consider our own happiness right now ends. When that moment of bliss, that moment of ecstasy, that moment, that peak, when that peak comes to an end, yeah, that's when the suffering starts. And however much we suffer now, and that's how much happiness we have when that which causes that suffering at the moment ends. And so we go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth for most of our life between those extremes. And we are, for the most part, quite incapable of appreciating what's in the middle. In fact, most of us, if there isn't any intense feeling of either happiness or any intense feeling of suffering, we go to sleep. Isn't it? We get up and we need our high. We need our whatever it is, cup of coffee, cocaine, whatever it is that we need to get up, yeah, in the morning to get our first high. Good breakfast, nice croissants, good cappuccino, yeah, the headlines in the newspapers, or whatever it is, you know, we need those highs. And if they're not there, then we get bored. Yeah. So the only thing is, we only know these extremes. We only know happiness and suffering, happiness and suffering. And whatever is in between is boredom to us. And that's why we go to sleep, if it doesn't happen. Yeah. And that's, of course, it's quite a predicament, isn't it? Because if we have to vacillate between happiness and suffering, you know, we can, you know, we don't need much wisdom to realize that, you know, how much happiness can we have? If we're lucky, as a human being, we get 50-50, isn't it? If we're really lucky, we get a bit more, you know, maybe 60-40. How much you got so far out of life? How much did you pay for your happiness with suffering? Yeah? So if we get 50-50, we're pretty good. We have a pretty good deal, isn't it? But the thing is, the price is there, it's to pay. If it's the smog of old age, or if it's some sort of sickness that comes later on, or somewhere else, or it's the loss of a loved one, whatever it is, you know, we're quite capable of bearing with even the suffering of life. In fact, it's quite amazing the amount of pain that people can endure if they have to. You know, if you look around in the world, whether it's the torture in concentration camps or the beating ups of whatever, or, you know, you name it. I mean, there's a lot of that out there, and it's quite extreme, you know, what people can suffer. And they can endure. They can endure because they have the hope that it will pass. There's always the hope that every moment of intense unhappy feeling will somehow pass. And that is the kind of worldly wisdom, if you like, that pulls us through, isn't it? Yeah. And in fact, it's also a bit of Buddhist wisdom, isn't it? Yeah, this too will pass, the impermanence factor of things. Because we've been there, done that, we've had it happen to us many, many times, that we went from one of these extremes to the other, and somehow it always turned around, and the happy moments came back. Of course, for some people they don't seem to come back. But is there an alternative? Is there an alternative to that? Yeah. Because it's very difficult if we are only used to those extremes in life to actually appreciate anything of a more subtle nature. And these days, let's face it, the amount of things that people put themselves through to get a hit are quite extreme, aren't they? You know, whether it's on the level of, you know, sexuality, or whether it's on the level of drugs, or whether it's on the level of whatever else it is. Yeah. Now, people need quite a significant amount of intensity of feeling to get that particular high. Obviously, it's not for everybody, but, you know, generally speaking, in the world, you can see that people need coarser and stronger and more intense things to get their high, to get their hit. And what that does, unfortunately, it dulls the mind to anything more subtle. So that, you know, when we actually try to do anything, you know, like we're trying to do here, when we come here to do meditation, as soon as we close our eyes, most of us just go to sleep. You know, and if we don't go to sleep, we start fantasizing, because we can't bear or endure, you know, the boredom of just watching a breath. I mean, how bad can it get? I mean, just watching a stupid breath. I mean, how, you know, I mean, who'd be foolish enough to, you know, just pay attention to the breath? I mean, how stupid can you get? Because, you know, what is this, the breath? You know, stupid breath. Why? What high? What hit can I get out of a breath? You know. And so the whole idea of peace, you know, becomes quite remote to most people. I mean, how to actually appreciate it? And the more intense our lives are, the more action driven we are, the more difficult we will find that whole approach to stilling and calming the mind and experiencing the beauty of peace and silence and emptiness of activity. I mean, emptiness of activity. I mean, to most people it sounds like a horror story, doesn't it? I mean, we're all here to have activity, aren't we? I mean, we're here to be active, to be alive, you know, to do something, to get out there, to live life. You know, who wants to have emptiness of activity? Yuck. And so how can we, you know, if we want to, try to make that mind able to perceive more subtle, more sublime, more subtle states, more subtle experiences, more subtle kinds of feeling or emotion? Because it takes a lot of paying attention to those things, and if we haven't got the right attitude to those things, then it becomes very, very difficult. And so we really have to, you know, look at the way we live our life. You know, how do we spend our day? You know, where do we actually allow for the mind to, you know, assume a more neutral, a more peaceful, a more sublime state of consciousness? Oftentimes in the busy world, in the busy day out there, it's very, very difficult to even find times where we can just be quiet and just be peaceful. Yeah. But one way of getting accustomed to those more sublime emotions is just the ability to embrace whatever we have to face in life. And that's why I was incredibly impressed today with the lady whose daughter died, because it was obviously a very painful experience, but there was something there that pulled her through. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was just the faith in something more to life than what meets the eye, or what we usually experience. And she had a very, very strong perception or recognition of the fact that there's something else to life. And there is a truth out there. There's something sublime. There's something there which is not tangible to our ordinary senses, but it's something there that she put her trust in. And you know, for me, I would just call it the Dhamma, you know, the teaching of the Buddha, the truth, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Because you find in the world, wherever people are able to cope with suffering or difficulties in life, yeah, ask yourself, well, what is it that pulls them through? What is it that keeps them going? Yeah. And oftentimes what it is a sense of something. I don't know, I'm sort of grappling for the right word. I want to call it supernatural, but just something that makes sense, something that is actually like a law, or a law of causality, you know, like that there's something that actually works according to a principle. Yeah? It's not random. You know, life is not random. Nor is life determined by a god. Yeah. It's not a chaos theory. It's not life is not happening by chance. Nor is life predetermined or destiny or all sort of figured out by some ruling supreme being somewhere, you know, who's got it all figured out. Because if it was, you know, what kind of a being would that be? Yeah. But the truth or the reality is the fact that, you know, we're all living out our own lives. And we're all the owners of our own actions. We're all the heirs of our own karma. Yeah? And the belief in that, yeah, the trust in the fact that there is some order, you know, some law, some natural principle that is actually working there. Yeah? Which allows us to take our lives into our own hands and then actually do something about our own lives ourselves without having to rely on a supreme God, nor just abandoning ourselves, you know, thinking that, well, what the hell, it doesn't matter what I do, you know, it's all just you know, random anyway. Yeah. And it's the trust or the faith in that that I think that particular lady just had. You know, she felt something that was giving her, you know, faith and hope that what has actually happened there, you know, it's not all bad. In fact, you know, she learned a lot, you know, through that experience, because, you know, she used it to her advantage, and she saw that no matter what she did anyway, she couldn't change it. You know, we can't change things which are happening according to cause and effect as much as we want. As soon as we start trying to change something that we can't change, we're going to suffer because we can't change it. Yeah? But if we can accept it And if we can see the fact that there is something at work there, you know, which works according to principles, to causality, you know, then it gives us the hope, you know, that we can actually do something about our own situation. And that is the beauty of the Dhamma. And wherever in the world you find people able to cope with difficulty, now you find they have something there. And obviously sometimes it's just a faith, obviously, they give up, they surrender, you know, to a god or something like that. I mean, that is also, you know, a possibility. But, you know, here I'm talking about, because obviously, you know, people who are connected to the Dhamma, connected to the teaching of the Buddha. And it's just so refreshing to see that. It's refreshing to see people who have made the teachings of the Buddha actually work for themselves. Yeah. And obviously the more peaceful, the more balanced people become, the more they have been able to make that teaching work. And, you know, one of the things for me, it's always something, you know, interesting to notice, you know, how, you know, I've become a lot more balanced. Yeah, the extremes of happiness and suffering, you know, they aren't as extreme as they used to be. Yeah. And that is as a result of, you know, having obviously been practicing for a while. And even though I'm, you know, far from at the end of the path, but it's just something that you can't help noticing. So you notice that how you start valuing peace more than the highs or the ups in life. And even if there are downs, you know, they're not as down as they used to be, because, you know, you're not craving the other extreme. So the whole situation becomes, you know, more balanced, more peaceful. Yeah. But that's something that for most people is quite difficult in the beginning, especially, to appreciate, you know, because obviously we've been so conditioned to always, you know, go for those extremes. And so that, you know, being able to, you know, balance ourselves out is not an easy thing. But again, the most, for me anyway, the most direct approach, you know, if one wanted to take that approach, is always the approach of wisdom. Because I find for myself that whenever I have that serious inquiry or willingness to inquire into a situation, that inquisitiveness, you know, that wanting to find out, that wanting to know, you know, regardless of what it is that I will find out. And there's always been that willingness to look deeper in order to find out more about a particular situation. Yeah. And that is what kept me going, what kept me, you know, going through, you know, being a monk for all these years. It's the willingness to look, to not look away, to not run away from situations, and just to face up to situations, and then contemplate, use my wisdom, use my understanding, use whatever I had gained in terms of wisdom and understanding and ability to contemplate and reflect, you know, and weigh things up. Because if we have that inquisitiveness, then it doesn't matter what situation we face up to, whatever situation we come into. You know, if we have the willingness to learn from it, then, you know, it doesn't matter. Yeah. It's that which pulls us through, and it is that which makes us actually look at the happiness that we experience with almost like a sense of detachment, and it also makes us look at the suffering we experience with a sense of detachment. And once we have that initial sense of detachment from the happiness and suffering that we experience throughout life, then we don't have we have a place from which we don't have that vested interest into things having to be happy, and the vested interest into things not being allowed to be suffering. We're quite able and quite capable to just accept whatever comes our way, because we're not after collecting, you know, little beads of happiness from here and there, but we're more interested in actually finding out the truth about those states of happiness, because we know, you know, as we go through life, and whatever happiness it is, it'll pass. Whatever suffering is, it will pass. Yeah? All the happy moments that I've had in my life, you know, where are they now? They're just memories. So what good is that? Yeah, what can I get out of a memory? What can I squeeze out of a memory? And nothing much, to be honest. And at least I can't. Yeah. Oh, yeah, some people live on memories, but you know, it's actually quite painful if I think of pleasant memories, because they're gone. I mean, that's what makes them suffering. And to me, anyway. Okay, if we can learn from them, good, great. You know, they got some value there, but other than that, they're just memories. And so the aim of life, you know, becomes much more a journey of understanding and willingness to investigate and look and learn from life than the mere collecting of happy moments and the frantic avoiding of anything unpleasant or painful. And so if we have that kind of courage, if we have that kind of framework, then obviously we also open ourselves up for the things in between those extremes. And so when we actually then start to meditate, you know, we're much more capable of bearing with a situation that, you know, at first is quite alien. You know, just to sit there and, you know, somebody says to you, just be in the present moment. Well, what the hell does that mean? You know? I mean, for most people, just to be in the present moment doesn't mean anything, because they don't even know what the present moment is. It's just such an alien concept. Yeah? Because we're either in the past or we're in the future. Yeah? So the present moment is something so strange. You know, at least if we try to consciously be aware of it, it's quite a strange thing for most people. Yeah? And then to be silent, well, that's even more strange. And most people are afraid of silence. As soon as people, I mean, I remember sitting with my mates in the old days. I mean, as soon as you didn't say anything for 2 or 3 minutes, say, "Are you all right?" You know, you just can't just sit there and just have no thoughts going on in your mind without somebody thinking you're weird. You know, and so, you know, to come to appreciate, you know, this sort of, you know, supposedly balanced and peaceful state of mind is quite difficult. It's quite strange. Yeah. But again, with the willingness and with the aim for wisdom, for understanding, you know, with that inquisitiveness, again, we've got some sort of incentive to just stick it out and just see what happens. You know, and just look and keep looking, because we're not running away. We're not afraid of whatever happens, because we've been there, done that. We've been happy. We've suffered. We've, you know, had this, been there, done that, had a lot of experiences. Yeah, but we've cultivated that willingness to the desire for understanding, for wisdom, for knowledge, you know, rather than for merely collecting happiness and avoiding suffering. And so that makes us strong. That gives us a kind of strength that most people in the world don't have. And so we can just look at the situation we're in, and without trying to change it, you know, without trying to, you know, make it, you know, anything, because we're not interested in making it anything other than it already is. And so that way, you know, we change, you know, radically. Change our whole outlook on life, yeah? Because we're here to look, to see, to observe, to understand, rather than to get something out of this. And so then when we start meditating, you know, the present moment, the idea of being present actually becomes something, you know, quite enjoyable. It becomes almost like a challenge where we say, well, look, present moment, you can just be whatever you like. I'm just going to watch. I'm just going to see what happens. I'm not going to change it. I'm not going to try to make it anything different from what it already is. And all I want to do is just to know. All I want to do is just to experience the reality of now. And that is quite radical. It's quite radical. But it is, to me anyway, the most effective way of, you know, allowing the meditation to happen. Because we can't make the meditation happen. Meditation isn't something that you can make happen. It's something that happens by itself. It happens literally when we get out of the way. When we stop making. When we stop trying to make something happen. When we stop doing the breathing. When we stop doing the present moment. When we stop creating silence. But when we actually look at what's already there. And it becomes, you know, quite fascinating. And it gives us, again, the way the Buddhist path, or the path of a practitioner or a meditator works, it's like that the meditation and the our daily life experience, that they always go together. You know, we can't somehow, you know, have our life run in one direction and then, you know, somehow expect that when we come home or do the meditation, you know, it's going to be completely different. So we have to have some it's almost like we have to apply the same attitude to both our life and the meditation, which effectively is the attitude of, you know, just doing what we need to do when we need to do things, and when we can't do things, we don't. We just leave things alone. So when we got a job to do, we do the job. When we got to do something, we do it. But then when we can't do anything, you know, whether it's in our life, you know, whether somebody has died, well, they're already dead. What can we do? Nothing. Already dead. So what's the point? You know? So you just accept it. You accept that their time was up. Yeah? And we don't know when our time is up. Yeah? We accept that also. Yeah? And so that takes away a lot of fear as well. Because a lot of us, you know, if we're not you know, lust or desire driven, we're actually fear driven. And we're trying to run away from what we think is going to be suffering. But we find if we actually have the courage to look, it's not. It's in fact something that we can learn from. It's something that, you know, can actually, you know, give us an insight into life. And so, you know, the meditation and our, you know, daily life, you know, should always be like a red thread going through both of it, because otherwise, if we just keep running all day long, and then we try to stop in the evening, we can't do it. You know, we have to keep that attitude of inquisitiveness, or we have to know what we want. We have to know what we're aiming for in life. If we really aim at peace, if we really aim at understanding, at developing wisdom, then that's something that, you know, should also, you know, drive us when we, you know, go through life, when we go and do our job, when we raise a family, and when we're with our husband, with our wife, with our children, or our friends. And so the most healthy attitude is obviously one that is sort of continuous, rather than, you know, vacillated between those extremes. you know, of now I'm trying to be a meditator, you know, and now I'm trying to go out there and indulge as much as I can, yeah, or whatever. And so finding that balance, you know, in our daily life, finding that balance in our meditation, finding a way of equalizing, if you like, the ups and downs of life. If that's something that we want to do. Most people, many people don't want to do it. They love the extremes. And of course, we can all see, I mean, those of us who've lived extreme lives, and I, for my part, wasn't born in a monastery. I lived out there long enough, and I had my extremes. And, there is a fascination there, of course. You know, there's a thrill, you know, a thrill of exciting, you know, even dangerous situations. But then again, there was always a price to pay. And I don't know one hit that I didn't pay a price for that was actually quite painful in the end. And so I sort of thought, well, is this how I want to live my life? Is this what I want to do? And in the end, I decided, nah, there's got to be something else. Because, you know, I was the sort of person who always suffered a lot when the peaks came to an end, when the high came to an end. A lot of people, a lot of my friends were able to kind of, whatever the word is, can't think of the word now, but like, you know, they were able to cope, you know, whereas I would always, when things ended, when things came to an end, which I, you know, had a lot of love for, then, you know, for me it was always painful, whereas other people, they seem to be able to just jump to the next thing, you know, very quickly. Yeah. So what is it then that we put our trust in? What do we put our faith in? Where do we start? And again, I always like to emphasize, you know, the Buddhist path, you know, being a very gradual path. It's a gradual training. And so wherever we're at, you know, we have to find that out. We have to see, well, you know, this is where we're at, and have to be very honest about it. And then we have to see, you know, where we can start. Making the Buddhist teaching work for ourselves. I mean, it's just, to me, it's always amazing just how much, you know, precious Dhamma there is in the Buddhist teaching. And it's always almost like depressing to see how little people actually utilize that. Because, well, for the most part, they just haven't got the time to even look and source the kind of material that is there and available. Yeah? And, sometimes we're just too lazy or, you know, whatever. Yeah? But it's just, there's so much precious material there that, you know, every time, you know, you open the suttas, you read some of the teachings, or you hear a talk by, you know, any of these, you know, amazing monks from the tradition, you know, through the centuries. There's always so much inspiring stuff there. And so we just have to look, you know, what works for us. You know, what is it that you know, gives us the faith and the trust to, you know, keep going, to do what we need to do. Whether it is the practice of, you know, living and being a good person. You know, if we can even do that much. You know, looking around in the world, you see how many people can you actually honestly say are really good people. I mean, they're there. There's many good people out there. The trouble is sometimes they're hard to see, hard to find. Because certainly in the media, it's not really what you know, people put out there. You know, when you read the newspapers, or you watch the television, or you hear the radio, it seems to be always, you know, quite depressing, you know, what comes across. But at the same time, there's so much good stuff happening out there. There's so many good things, you know, that people get up to. There's so many kind and helpful and generous and compassionate people, you know, who live their lives for the benefit of others, yeah, and themselves. Yeah. And so it's just, you know, looking, keeping our eyes open, keeping our ears open, you know, and you know, looking in places where, you know, perhaps we usually don't look, and see if we can find something inspiring, something uplifting, you know, that gives us, you know, more courage, more hope to, you know, put the teaching into practice for ourselves, and then, you know, gives us that inspiration, you know, to keep going, you know, both in our daily life, and you know, to be a good person and be a good Buddhist in our daily life. And at the same time, never forget that the heart of the Buddhist teaching is always the meditation. It's the cultivation of our own heart, the cultivation of our own mind. You know, the virtue is a foundation, yes. Yeah. But never stop short, you know, at just being a good person. It's good, great. If that's all you can do, well, great, good on you already. But, you know, what I'm saying is, you know, that's not all there is. There's more. There's more to the Buddhist teaching. There's more to the path. And there's amazing things out there waiting for us if we can only, you know, manage to walk that path. Yeah. I mean, like I say, anybody whoever gets into any, you know, nice meditation, they'll never forget that for the rest of their life. It's something, it's a memory that will stick with you, you know, for the rest of your life, even if you just get into a nice samadhi once. Because it's just beyond this world. It's otherworldly happiness. It's a happiness that, you know, no orgasm and no ecstasy and nothing else can get anywhere near, you know. And it's all there in your own mind. You don't need anything for it. You don't need any pills for it. You don't need nothing for it, you know. It doesn't cost anything. And that's why it's just amazing, you know. And it's something that, you know, is there for everyone, you know, based on, you know, being a good person, to cultivate the mind in meditation, finding the incentive, finding the incentive to do it again and again and again and again, and never give up, never give up, never give up, never give up. You must eventually succeed, because it's a cause and effect sequence, it's a natural process, you know, whether you like it or not. It will happen if you put in the causes. It's not up to anyone else. It's just cause and effect. Cause and effect, cause and effect. If you put in the right causes, you create your own happiness. If you put in the wrong causes, you create your own suffering. It's that simple. So, that's a bit of a rambler here for you today on the ups and downs of life. So, I hope I didn't bore anyone stiff with it. So, I hope you get your high tonight. If not, at least you've got a bit of suffering. That's better than being bored to stiff, isn't it? Okay. So, does anybody want to ask any questions? Have any comments on the talk tonight? Well, it is. Like, I mean, we have to, one thing we have to realize is, like, those experiences, because they are not like something that we create, but there's something that happens because of causes that have been put in. And a lot of these causes have been put in, say, over many lifetimes. And a lot of times, you know, we would have experienced those states of samadhi, say, states of deep meditation, you know, previously. Yeah. And so sometimes it just seems that people kind of fluke, almost like fluke those experiences, and they just get back there. Yeah. And there's one monk in the monastery, and the reason he's a monk is because as a layperson he just went into a jhana. And he could never forget that again. You know, it was always the carrot. You know, he always wanted to get that back. But of course, the craving and the desire to get it back is almost like an obstacle to getting it back. Yeah? But nevertheless, it was a carrot for him to try and give it a try. You know, and so, you know, it's nice when these things happen, because they keep us going. They're like the carrot, and they keep us, you know, pointed in the right direction. So no, it's good. It is. Whenever we get into a meditation, I mean, every time I get into a really nice meditation, I think afterwards, why can't it always be like that? It's very simple. You know, because you know, it's just like the meditation takes off when you let go, you know, and the mind just takes over and things just happen, you know, and you just sit there and watch, and you watch it happen, and you kind of go, it's that easy. Yeah. But most of the time we try doing it, and because we try doing it, we can't do it. So letting go is something we can't do. We just have to let it happen. Get out of the way. Any other comments or questions? Okay. And call it a night then. Okay. Thanks for coming.